Welcome back, everyone. I'm Louis Vargas, and you're listening to episode 59 of the Art Scene Podcast. Today's guest is Shannon Rogers, an artist based out of Oakland, California. You'll hear us as we discuss his early beginnings in Little Rock, Arkansas, and his growth as an artist, exploring geometric abstraction during his studies at the SAIC in Chicago and the New York Studio School. We also discussed his experience as an art professor, and finally, his second solo show, which is currently on view at Part 2 Gallery in Oakland, titled Dreamlands. But before I play our conversation, here are some shows around the Bay Area to check out. In addition to Shannon's show at Part 2, there is also two other solo shows. One is titled Painting Head Body Sculpture, featuring the work of Isaac Avila, a former guest of the podcast. And the other is Golden Crucible by artist Yashkin Fuentes Barrientos. Both shows run until September 6th. Closing this weekend at SF MoMA on September 2nd is Ruth Asao Retrospective. It is the first posthumous retrospective presenting the full range of Asawa's work over the 6 decades of her career. And then across the street over at the YBCA, Bay Area Then has recently opened, bringing together historic and new works by artists such as Bill Daniel, Nao Bustamante, Barry McGee, Joanna Jackson, and others. The show runs till January 25th, 2026. All right, now here's Shannon and I. Shannon, it's nice to meet you in person, and nice, it's good to have you, and good to be here in your studio here at Part 2 Gallery. Too, I realize you're not originally from California.
No, I'm not.
You're from Arkansas, right?
That's correct.
I have so many questions about that. But the first one I want to talk about is tell me about where you came from in Arkansas, like,
sure.
And what was kind of your background and how you got into art.
Yeah, so I grew up in Little Rock, it's the capital of Arkansas, right in the middle of the state. My father is a lighting and interior designer. He ran his own business, you know, still does. My mother's a graphic designer.
Okay.
So art was always like a part of our family. There's a lot of creative endeavors going on. My sister's now a chef. Well, it's kind of something that we do is make things.
What led your parents to be in, are they also from Arkansas too?
They're originally from Arkansas.
Okay.
Yeah. So my dad grew up in central Arkansas. His family moved to Alaska for a little while. They came back to Arkansas. My mom is from North Little Rock. So all, you know, based in central Arkansas.
And only because I don't know much about Little Rock, Arkansas.
Sure.
Is there a lot of cultivation of art that they were like, felt like this is where we can still continue to make things and be art makers of some sort in Little Rock? Like,
there's definitely a community of artists.
Yeah.
It's hard to get by as an artist in Arkansas. There are some who do, and they really work hard to make that happen. Growing up, my dad was part of a community of visual artists. They would throw these, you know, art parties where they'd get a model and a bunch of wine and play music and draw and paint. So as a kid, I would go there and draw with them and help clean up.
That's really
make
cool.
Sure everybody made it home.
Yeah.
I went to a magnet school for elementary school that had an art class.
Yeah.
And we had a great art teacher. So in first grade, she had students standing on tables and other students drawing them.
Yeah.
Like a life drawing class.
Yeah. Wow, your parents really were encouraging too, even.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
Yeah, to the point that like they were encouraging me to go to art school, and at first I was a little hesitant. I went to the University of Arkansas for like a year and a half, and I applied undecided, but they'd just gotten, I don't know, like $1 billion from the Waltons or something, $750 million. I can't remember how much money. And so they just put me into business school as a business major.
I signed
up for small business management and thought, who knows, maybe I'll be an artist, maybe I'll have a gallery, I don't know. After a year and a half, I was like, I can't do this. And I came home and told my dad I wanted to transfer and wanted to go to art school, and he was like, finally, you know, which is like the opposite of what most people experience.
Well, but almost similar, right? Like, I mean, if you come from a family of lawyers, they're like pushing to be a lawyer,
sure.
And then you're like, and then you're out on it, and you're like, want a transfer? No, I'd rather just go be a history major. I'm fine.
Right. You finally come around.
Yeah.
So going back to being a kid, like when I was in eighth grade, my dad went and signed me up for figure drawing classes at the Arkansas Arts Center after school.
Yeah.
They were like, he's, you know, 13 or 14 or something. Like, you can't be here. There's yeah. naked people in here.
Yeah, yeah.
So he signed a waiver and had to take the class with me. And
amazing.
That was when, like, I started doing figure drawing and life drawing.
Yeah. And you really liked that? Like, you were, like, really, like, at this point, I would assume you're just all in on it.
Yeah, that was pretty much what I did, was just mostly figure drawing. It started to get into landscape once I was actually in college. So, like, drawing people. I didn't really paint when I was young. So I didn't paint until I was in art school. So once I spent the year and a half in business school, I ended up transferring to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Okay.
And
that's where you went for undergrad?
Yeah. Wow. That's where I got my BFA.
Wow. So then you went a whole different part of the country.
Yeah, I just jumped right to
Chicago. And was that on purpose? Like, you just wanted to go do something different, like experience
a different...
Well, I was
looking at several different schools.
Yeah.
We visited a school in New York.
Yeah.
School of Visual Arts, but New York was, you know, I'd really never spent any time in a city like that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so it was a lot, and tuition was high.
Yeah.
And SAIC actually gave me a little bit of scholarship money and, like, some work study. So the student loans weren't, I mean, they were still insane, but it wasn't the whole thing.
Right.
And they had a really nice program. It's more conceptual. I mean, they have some really good teachers, you know, really good.
Right.
And I studied with some really great people. But it was a little bit like you're kind of embattled as, like, if you're, you know, like a figure painter at SAIC, they're like, what are you doing? Do you even care about this? You're just taking classes? You know? So I feel like I went through some brutal critiques and had to learn to kind of defend my work. And it just made me kind of entrench. But I had teachers that, like, I did a lot of figure painting. They, you know, if you paint the figure, they're gonna have you paint the room. As I paint the figure in the room, the figure's getting smaller and the room's getting bigger. Mm-hmm. And Susanna Coffey was one of my painting teachers, and she was like, you want to paint, you know, you keep painting windows, the figure's like teeny tiny in the painting.
People
now
became less
the
important.
Whole room is there, and so, like, you need to go out and paint the landscape.
Yeah.
And so I'd come into class and she would be like, get your shit and go outside. You know, it's March in Chicago. But yeah, started painting landscape. And so through undergraduate was really just like a kind of hard representational painter. Never from photographs, always from direct observation.
Yeah.
And it was in grad school in New York that abstraction became rationalized. I started to see it in representational painting.
But what ended up being the grad schools you ended up going to in New York?
The New York Studio School.
So what was the difference, you think? So if AIC was, like, really conceptual, what was the school in New York like? Like, was it more of your choice? When you went to that school, was it more like, this is more in line with what I want?
I think I kind of knew better what I wanted.
Yeah.
SAIC was really good.
Yeah.
It pushed me and it broadened my understanding of painting. I mean, I really didn't know much about, like, fine art and art history.
Right.
So it was great. It exposed me to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And being attached to a museum was incredible. I mean, at lunch, like, you just go into the backside of the Art Institute of Chicago and go see your favorite painting or just kind of putz around, whatever.
Yeah.
So that was phenomenal. The New York Studio School is tiny.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's above Washington Square
Park. Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
And the dean of the school, Graham Nixon, was a painter that I really admired and just speaks really eloquently about painting and dips into history and makes it feel contemporary in all these incredible ways. They do these drawing marathons. There was an artist locally in Arkansas who'd done a drawing marathon.
Yeah.
He was a really great guy and a devoted painter, but his drawing was a little bit kind of... He went to this drawing marathon, he came back, and he was like a different artist. You know, the drawings were like beautiful. And I was like, damn, this is incredible. It was 10 days. What happened? You know?
Yeah.
So I was very impressed. We visited the school, but they didn't offer an undergraduate degree. And I wanted a proper degree.
Right.
So they were always on my radar. But they had like a certified MFA program. So when grad school came around, I didn't apply anywhere else.
Yeah, because that was the dream school anyway.
That's
that
kind
was
of where like I wanted to go. And yeah. They had a lot of really good representational painting going on. And I thought that's what I would do. And it was interesting to me that I became much more interested in abstraction while I was there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was that, like, it was a supportive environment, so I felt a little more secure to, like, explore or what. But
did you try to do abstraction when you were at undergrad? Or like
at various points I did, and it always just felt very arbitrary to me, and I didn't have a hook. I didn't have, like, something to hold on to. And I feel like I need some rational reason. Mm-hmm. As a beginning for a painting. I mean, at some point with my current practice, like in a long studio session, I'll get so exhausted I'm just making decisions. When the painting begins, I'm always trying to reason out why I'm doing something and how these things are interacting and for what purpose. So abstraction felt arbitrary. And finding like abstracts, it was actually drawing from older paintings at the Met. Or we had this teacher, Stanley Lewis, who would come in, and he's a real character. He's like very compelling person because he's just so passionate, almost to like a maniacal level. Like he just gets worked up. He draws so intensely that he like tears through the paper he's drawing on. He just starts drawing on the next page in the sketchbook, you know?
Yeah.
But he loves to draw from old paintings. And that always felt really stiff to me.
Yeah.
But he was finding all these ridiculous things in the paintings. And at first you think he's just kind of going on a lark. But then you start to see, like, indulging those ideas opens all these doors for where the painting goes or how the reading of the painting goes.
Yeah.
And so instead of telling myself, I don't think they meant to do this, or I'm making up something that they're doing, I started telling myself, if they did mean to do this, where does that lead you?
Yeah.
You know? And you start finding all these interesting connections in, you know, historical painting that feel very abstract and contemporary.
Yeah. Okay, so then when you finished grad school and now you got your MFA as well, it's kind of, well, what's crazy to me is that you've had like the two educations, right? Because I remember even when I was going to grad school and, you know, well, before I even ended up just getting an MA in museum studies, but I was a photographer. I did photography, and I wanted and applied to MFA programs. But I remember one of the biggest things people then would tell me was, "What school do you want to go to?" And I didn't come from an art family or background, so I didn't know. But like, I would apply to these schools, and they're like, "Well, are you sure you want to go there? Because they're not conceptual." And like, "Or do you want that one? Because that one is conceptual." And I remember being like, "I don't understand. What do you mean? The difference?" And then my professors would tell me, like, you know, "Well, here's the deal. Like, if you go to this school, this is where they're going to try and push you." And I think it was at that point I realized I love photography. I think I'm more interested in like the history of the medium more than I was, I think, which went, I meant the MA route in the end. But so I'm curious now that you got to experience both of them, like in your lifetime, basically. So one for undergrad and the other for graduate school today, what do you feel like? Do you feel like your work has been able to encompass both educations, or you feel like it's one's more heavier influencing your work than the other?
I think when I was an undergraduate, you know, like I came from a creative family, but I didn't have a lot of art history background.
Right.
We weren't going to galleries. There was the Arkansas Art Center, now the Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts, got a little makeover, and it's a beautiful building now, and they have a nice collection, and they always have had a nice collection. But going to school in Chicago was like really eye-opening. It let me know, you know, how kind of young I was as an artist. And so I wasn't ready to take in a lot of the painting and sculpture and art practices that I encountered, but it was a primer. There were people I liked making work I didn't understand and couldn't attach to, but it's been like percolating. And so I think that has always laid the groundwork for, you know, wanting to have a broader interest in art. Whereas I think if I went to a very traditional program, I could have kind of walled myself off.
Yeah.
And I don't think my painting would be as flexible as it has been. Flexible, in my opinion, maybe still pretty rigid to some people. So that's the benefit I see. From Chicago, they have a program that you're not like declaring a major and on a set track. you have your interests. You can take classes across mediums and disciplines. There are bars for like barriers for entry for some advanced classes where you have to have had some prerequisite, but I was able to take sculpture and animation and printmaking and a lot of things, just kind of dip my toe in some different practices, and kept coming back to painting. So it felt like what I knew I wanted to do. And then in grad school, it was like a deep dive into painting. And the general culture was like, you should be putting in like 12 hours a day painting. Wow. You should draw every day.
Like,
this has to be your life if you want to make progress. That's not exactly how I lived through grad school, painting 12 hours a day every day. But it set the seed for like, you really need to devote yourself to the practice to make the most of it. And was like inspiring. So it was, you know, both had a very distinct and important role in my development, I think, as a painter.
Okay, so then you finished grad school. Where did you go to next? Did you stay in New York?
You know, when I was in New York, I thought I would. And then grad school ended and I had no money and all these big paintings. And there was a travel grant that the school offered that I really wanted to get, and I didn't. So I decided I still wanted to travel. I needed money for that. It wasn't going to happen in New York so easily, and I had to get my paintings home anyway.
Yeah, I can't even imagine all the stuff that you had to like empty out.
So I like rent a U-Haul and, you know, pick it up in New Jersey and like drive through Manhattan. The whole time I was living there, I'd never like driven a car in Manhattan. All of a sudden, I'm in this box truck. But I load up the paintings and drive them back to Arkansas. End up, you know, getting some work doing like faux finishing. My dad has a warehouse space that I'm able to kind of carve a little corner out of, start painting and drawing. Ended up traveling with a friend, several friends, to India and then through Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, which was a very fun trip. Not exactly art-oriented as I'd intended originally, but very cool. And when I got back, I lucked into an old painting friend was in my neighbor's backyard. And she's a great painter and a very dynamic person, and I'm in my backyard and she says, "What the fuck are you doing in Arkansas?" And
I was like,
you know, I just finished grad school and I'm back. She was like, "I'm teaching now at Henderson State University and I need a drawing teacher." And I was like, "I've never taught drawing." She's like, "I just need somebody to put these kids in front of an easel, draw what they see, and just beat the hell out of them."
Well, and the beauty was you have an MFA, which is like gives you the qualifications to just do that, which is amazing.
She hired me on as an adjunct professor. Nice. I think I was making like $1,200 per course per semester, you know, like just nothing. It was like an hour plus drive down to the school, but it was very cool. So I had drawing one and drawing two to start with. And then their life drawing teacher retired. So I picked up a life drawing class and an advanced drawing class, and we just set up easels and draw. I tried not to be as brutal as some of my teachers have been in undergraduate, but getting them to not feel too precious about their drawings coming up and erasing part of their drawing and just kind of seeing how they react, you know, not destroying something they worked on for a full day, but right at the beginning coming up and saying, "Let's rework this area." Like, it was a very rewarding process to get to work with students.
Yeah, well, it's probably cool too because it's almost like you recognizing my teachers were pretty brutal, but there was some positive outcome out of them being brutal on me. But when you got to be in that same position, you were able to make the balance.
I tried it.
Right? Or at least try it.
I'm sure some of them were like, "This..."
But I think most importantly, you wanted them to understand, because obviously this must have been a smaller college compared to like the Art Institute. And so I could imagine that you were like, "I'm trying to give you almost an Art Institute education, but not be as like..."
Unfortunately for some of them, I mean, it's a drawing one class.
Right,
you know, some of them are like, I'm doing this for fun. I'm trying to get an easy A, and I'm in there like, "We're going to be standing at the easel for 3 hours every class. Let me see your homework." I think there were definitely a lot of students who were like, "This is way too much."
Yeah.
But there was a crew of, you know, art kids who... they really got into it, and they made some beautiful work. And I think several of them ended up going to grad school for art and, you know, really pursuing it. And so, Yeah, it's really rewarding to see people attached to it. And even people who weren't going to take it much further and had like no confidence going in. And you could see it in the group critiques. Like they're the people who already have an established skill set and are very confident, and people who really don't know what they're doing and feel lost. It was a good exercise for me. And I think, you know, confidence building for them to like find something that they're doing in their work that the other students are not doing. And so to point out, like, there's something happening in this drawing that like all of you can benefit from.
Yeah.
So to kind of like raise them up in the community of students, and make everybody, you know, look at each other's work in a way that isn't like, oh, you didn't draw that hand well and I drew it well.
That's
but
right.
Like look at the abstract structure of like darks in this composition and how it's breaking up the rectangle. Like you're stuck in the figure because you're still working on that hand.
Yeah.
They did the whole drawing,
right?
You know, in 20 minutes. So like loosen up, do the whole thing and then come back to it. There's a way to like, yeah, make everybody a little more synergistic and like build the whole skill set.
That
as a painter, it's a good reminder too.
Yeah.
But I also had a teacher who was like, don't teach too quickly out of school, because like a teacher's mindset and an artist's mindset, I think, are different. And I already lean into this, like I need to be very rational and logical. You know, I think if I ended up teaching for 2 years.
Wow.
But if I'd stayed, I feel like I would have just really tightened up and narrowed in on exactly what I do instead of been a little more playful with it.
Now, this whole time you're teaching, are you finding a way to still exhibit your work at least there or anywhere else?
I ended up having a show. So this was like 2012, maybe it started fall 2011. And I left Arkansas in 2014. And right before I left, I had a show of paintings.
Yeah.
At a place called the Thea Foundation. It's a nonprofit. But I was able to show landscape painting and the abstractions that I'd made from the landscape painting.
Yeah.
Through grad school, I'd shown a little bit of work with another gallery in Arkansas, but they wanted traditional landscape. And when I started showing them abstraction, they were like, that's not really what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And I also, I guess that was between grad school and undergrad, we did a little gallery space in the like front office of where my father was running his lighting and interior design business. It was like a small building downtown that had a little front window with some lighting, and we put up a few shows there. But I didn't show my own work, I don't think. We showed some other people from undergrad. So I wasn't really showing.
Yeah. But you were still practicing.
Yeah, I had a studio. I'd, you know, paint on the days I was off. I was still doing a lot of plein air painting.
Yeah.
So it was during the time after grad school that I developed a habit of like working on a painting for months. I mean, not daily on the same painting for months. There were even a couple of paintings where I came back, it was like over a year because the lighting needed to be right.
Right.
But there's like a painting I did of a bridge over the Arkansas River, which runs right through Little Rock and North Little Rock, that stretched over, you know, 3 seasons. It went from like late winter through the spring into early summer, and you can kind of see it in the way the color changes.
Yeah.
So there's this like, for me anyway, I'm sure for a lot of people, painting the landscape, especially being outside, it's hectic, right? The wind's blowing, things are moving,
right?
A lot of noise, bugs, whatever. It might be hot. And things are changing. It's kind of a ridiculous proposition to like catch what you're looking at.
Right. And then memorize it for like 5-10 seconds to keep it going.
Well, yeah, it's impossible, right?
Yeah.
And that feels like this impossible hurdle until you just like accept it.
Yeah.
And then it's the most interesting thing about the painting is that it's this like accumulation of experiences. And so the longer you look at it, the more you see these discrepancies that like it's spring over here and it's late summer over here. Like all the grass has died. You know, you go from like green lush to like dry golden grass. And that I think planted the seed for thinking about time in paintings,
right?
And like how a painting can hold time in some sense. It wasn't as explicit as it became in the abstract paintings, but it was a beginning of like thinking about this.
Right.
Catching a fourth dimension on a two-dimensional surface.
Yeah. Okay, so you did 2 years. So I'm curious why...
I served my 2 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so I was wondering what your take was on teaching, but it sounds like it was, like, a nice experience for you, but not the career that you wanted for yourself.
I really enjoyed it. I would totally be down to teach again.
Yeah.
But I not found at that it really fulfilling.
Time. Yeah.
At that point, I didn't want to stay in Arkansas.
That's what it came down
and
to.
Yeah, yeah, so, like, I tried to apply to a couple of places when I moved out to California
teach. Like, yeah, that was like kind of, you were like, trying to use that as your gateway to leave.
Yeah, most of them wanted more experience than just 2 years.
Oh, interesting.
But for whatever reason, didn't get any callbacks on that. So I was in Arkansas. I was finishing up my fourth semester teaching. I'd picked up, like, I was teaching four courses at that point, and another painter in Arkansas, Matt Lopez, who taught at a private school, Hendrix, he invited me to teach a couple courses for a semester while he was on sabbatical. So I was teaching at two schools and teaching six courses and still, like,
and that was enough
waiting
experience?
Tables. It didn't catch. But still waiting tables to build up enough money to make my escape.
Yeah.
I had some friends visit who were living in the Bay. They were back in Arkansas. We were hanging out and talking, and I was like, I'm trying to get out of here. And one of them was living in Oakland with an artist co-op, and they were building out a new building. Mm-hmm. He was like, here's the floor plan. I got an apartment for like $600 a month.
This is like 2014, you said?
Yeah, 2014.
Yeah, yeah. They were starting to pop up in Oakland a lot.
Yeah, so I moved out without having been to California and got this little apartment and...
So that was the connection, was because you had friends that were already here. And
yeah, kind of, I didn't know where I was going to go, and they were like, we're in California, it's great. I was like, cool.
Yeah, and it's what you were thirsty for too, right? You wanted that, like, you wanted to keep doing your practice, but be around more people that kind of...
Yeah, and I wanted a more, like, culturally saturated environment.
Yeah.
You know? People are making it work in Arkansas, but it's hard.
Yeah.
And I missed New York, but it's hectic and it's dense.
Yeah.
And while I was in Arkansas, I was kind of like reestablishing a connection to nature. So sort of without knowing it, California feels like this bridge between the two.
Yeah, totally.
Like the landscape is gorgeous and it's easy to get to.
Right.
And there's still that like cultural density, like...
yeah, you can get the big city.
Metropolitan,
right? Yeah.
Feel like... So it's been really good.
I'm from San Diego, which is, it has a city, like a downtown, mm-hmm. like any other big city, but I didn't realize how slow that was until I came to San Francisco, and I thought San Francisco was like San Diego on steroids. And then it was funny. Then I went to visit New York, and I was like, oh, this is what a real metropolitan is like.
Yeah.
And then I realized that San Francisco was like, this girl was the perfect balance between the two, because I think there was times where I'm like, I think my small town, beach town background still is part of me. And I said, mm-hmm. I don't think I can fully be immersed and stay in New York for like long periods of time, because I'm probably like, because it was a hectic, it was fun. It's
a
great city.
It takes a special person to live there for a long
totally,
time.
Totally. Yeah. And I have fun every time I visit, but it's just like, to live there was like, having lived in San Francisco, it was like, no, this is the right pace for me. Like, it's it's faster than San Diego, but not too fast. So it's funny that you came to that kind of, and you had never even visited, which is even crazy.
Serendipity, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, so then you get here. Did you go straight to move into Oakland? Like, is that where you went?
Yeah, I moved right into Oakland.
Yeah, and you're still in Oakland, right?
I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I thought, you know, when I got here, I was like, well, maybe I'll live in Oakland for a while. Maybe I'll move to San Francisco, maybe even LA at some point. But I've really come to love being in Oakland, being in the East Bay.
And once you're here, now you're like, you got a studio, you're like working.
It's been a slow build.
Yeah. But then, like, what was the connection? How did you get exposed to people that where they now were seeing your work? You're like, we want to start showing you at different places here.
Yeah. So I got here in 2014. I was painting out of my apartment, out of my room.
Yeah.
The first room I had, it was like the size of a queen mattress with a little 4x4 foot scab on by the window.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I had my bed there and I would sit by the window and paint what was out the window.
Yeah.
So from there, I waited tables for a minute, which I'd done in Arkansas, and then got a job art handling, which I didn't really know was
like a thing.
A thing. Right. Until I got out of here. I had a friend from art school who was like, "Well, you should, you know, you're a tall guy, you know, art materials
they
and how things
always need
move.
Tall guys.
You should be an art handler. They'll hire you. Just tell them you're 6.5 feet tall and you'll get a job."
So put
that
true.
In my email. And they asked me to come in for an interview, and I walked in, and Dagan, one of the owners of Norton Fine Art at the time, was like, "Wow, he really is 6.5 feet tall." Like, it landed.
So, you know, I'll tell you,
Nicholas Quint.
And so that listeners understand this, I work at an art museum, right? Yeah. And as a registrar, you know, you oversee like a crew of people that are installing the show, right?
Right.
And it's so true. Like, I remember at a MoMA, we had all these old timers that were there and some mid timers, and they were not above 6 foot.
Right.
And we were doing crazy shows where like there would be tall paintings or even just like having to lift something up higher, like a sculpture or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to always use a ladder or a lift.
Yeah.
And I tell you, like, 1 year we got this guy who was 6'5", and they were so excited. But you really do need people like that. And
it helps.
It really helps. And especially like, and like you mentioned, like being an art handler is a thing. Like there's a craft to it. There's skill set to it.
Yeah.
And if you can get someone who's that tall, like you like on the tee.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those things where you also need like strong people. Like not just tall people, but even if you're short, but like where you can lift heavy things. And you also need the short guy because he can get to places that you can't. It's really crazy. Like, really, people think about that. And it's so, yeah, you showed up at the door and you're like, "Yep, we need this guy. You're hired."
Yeah, it got me in the door for sure. So I worked with them for like 2 years and ended up getting. So there's another guy, Nicolas Colon, who runs climate control in San Francisco now. He was living in Mexico City, but he was coming back to San Francisco to grow up here and picking up a little work. And I met him through. I think he went to high school with Peter Hopi's brother, who became the new owner of Norton, still owns it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started working together. On one of his subsequent trips back to San Francisco, he worked with Minnesota Street Project. So he was like, "You should come check this place out." I ended up working with them. I still work with them. But through work as an art handler, I met Brock. I met a lot of artists and other art handlers, and we work with galleries and art consultants. So when I lost my studio, so I was in a studio from like 2016, 2017 to 2019, just before the pandemic hit, it was by Tokyo Fish House. Right up San Pablo.
Mm-hmm.
That building got bought and they kicked everybody out.
Jesus.
So I was studio-less and kind of hunting around, and there are a lot of very expensive and not so great studio options, but it's hard to find a good studio that feels like a fair price. And I knew Brock was like in the mix, so I reached out to him to see if he knew of any spaces. And he didn't at the time, but then he came back, you know, maybe a month or two later and said he had a space opening up here. And so getting into part two, especially during the pandemic. I think I moved in like June 2020.
Wow.
So like kind of in it.
Yeah.
Still being able to see shows downstairs when they got put on.
Yeah.
Having a place to come and work was pretty phenomenal. And from there, I felt like the community really started to build. So exposure through like the day job, building community in the studio here just helped to meet a lot of people.
But throughout that whole period of time, though, even up to 2020, you're doing group shows, you're doing, like, you're submitting, you're doing stuff, right? Like, you're showing around town.
Yeah, so I showed a couple of places. I showed with Hang Art in San Francisco for a while, with Piero.
Yeah.
So some of the early abstract painting, when I first started making non-objective paintings, I was showing them with Piero. And we were showing together through, like, 2019. And then after that, did a couple of group shows, and mostly was just up here painting through about 2020, I guess it was maybe, 2024 was the first time I was in a group show at Part 2.
Wow.
Over the summer, and then had the show in the fall. But you know, people like I shared this studio with Brad Flanagan, who's shown with the gallery. Mm-hmm. I replaced Cannon Dill, who moved to LA, so yeah. I got his spot. And then there have been several other painters in here. Esteban, who you talked to,
yeah,
we shared the space for a while, and then he ended up moving next door and sharing a space with Landon Pointer. Mm-hmm. And then Yaskin, who's showing downstairs right now with me, he was in here for a while as well.
Wow.
And it was like summer 2024 that Yaskin moved out of this space, and Brock was like, if you want, you know, the whole studio, you can like try to get the whole space. So
that's really great.
Yeah, it's been very cool to have like a big studio space. I kind of miss having another painter in here.
You like the little bit of the
I can get very bouncing. Like I can get very locked in.
Yeah.
And so just walking in and seeing what somebody else is doing is always cool. Like
yeah.
just the way they're approaching it, their rhythm in the studio.
Well, sometimes too, it's like a built-in critic too, right? Like where you like if you need feedback, they're right there, and
yeah.
vice versa, because I'm sure they would sometimes hit you up. But it's like nice to have it, but it's like safe, right? It's not
yeah.
like a traditional critique where they're ripping you apart.
That's right. Yeah, it's a little more polite. Nobody's trying to prove
it's
anything.
It's more encouraging.
Yeah. Art school is a brutal place.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about your practice, because
okay.
you've referenced it all through so far this conversation
sure.
of like the growth of your art and stuff. And okay, so you mentioned how earlier on, even like during your undergrad years, even you were kind of doing like landscapes and like what was it? Were they looking like traditional landscapes at that point? And it was grad school when you really started going a little bit more geometrical.
Yeah.
And when did you finally said I'm going all in on this abstract geometric
right.
shape type of art? Like was that in during grad school or afterwards?
After. So yeah. like loosely bracketed undergrad was all strict representational painting and
yeah.
trying to learn to mix color to what I saw
yeah.
and to create an image that had light, had a sense of mass, a sense of space, you know, work on my drawing, like kind of traditional formal qualities.
Yeah.
Always with kind of a heavy hand with the paint, like the mark was always very apparent in my paintings, you know, so it wasn't going like academic.
Right.
Grad school, I started to, like I was saying earlier, I was able to rationalize abstraction in a way that let me in. So I would start with a landscape painting, you know, it would be, I was drawn to like overpasses, these very like urban landscapes that would break up the skyline, break up the horizon, have little pockets of light, in unexpected places, playing with things like street signs with one-way arrows, you know, to
right.
play with the composition.
Right.
But taking those into the studio, having a studio in grad school, like I didn't want to just make a big version of the small landscape painting.
Right.
It felt like it undermined the value of that landscape painting.
Right.
So I started to try and use that landscape painting as a jumping off point and look for some abstract structure in the composition, break up the image, play with color, play with really strong color. And through grad school, the two were tightly interlinked. So I would spend a lot of time, even after grad school back in Arkansas, spend a lot of time on a landscape painting, bring it into the studio, do a version, you know, if it was 18 by 24, I would do, you know, whatever, 5 by 3 by 4 foot painting, maybe bigger.
Yeah.
I don't think I did anything that was like 6 by 8 feet, but
And always on canvas. And always on canvas.
Always on canvas.
Yeah.
And sometimes on board.
Yeah.
But the oil paint kind of slides on wood in mm-hmm. a way that I like the way it sits in the knit of canvas.
Yeah.
The fabric. I mean, linen as well. Linen and canvas.
Yeah.
The paint just sits on the surface differently.
Yeah.
And I like a coarse weave.
Yeah.
So that it really holds the paint.
Yeah.
Yeah, so abstracting from landscape. And then when I moved to California, I was working full-time. It's tiring work. And I was still making observational paintings, but it was taking a long time to get them where I wanted them to be. And abstracting from them was still happening on a small scale.
Yeah.
But just looking at like the trajectory of how much painting I would be able to get done to put together a show to try to build something for myself for, you know, for a career as a painter.
Yeah.
It felt like a really long timeline. And I just wasn't getting as much painting done as I wanted because I was really tied to these times of day. You know, if I started like a twilight painting out this window of the gas station that I painted probably 4 or 5 times, it needed to be kind of a cloudy day where the sun was setting in a similar spot, and it really slowed things down. So I just started making these non-objective paintings. And they started as the like abstract bones of the representational paintings I'd been making.
Yeah.
Which is usually these geometric volumes that
right.
kind of break up the space.
And then you start to like refine it or whatever, and like that's interesting.
Yeah, so the paintings have always been about space, trying right. to make space, you know, the sort of phenomenal nature of painting, this flat surface that can show you a depth of field or make you feel like you see something that you know isn't there.
Right.
And so when I started making the abstract paintings, the non-objective paintings, they were like this shallow vibrational space. So yeah. intense color that kind of maybe is this low relief. And I think they move those sort of linear abstractions. The space has gotten deeper and deeper until there are these planar abstractions I'm making now that feel a lot closer to landscape or still life. And I intend to have a similar depth of field
yeah.
to landscape painting.
Yeah. Well, and it's, what's interesting is like, it's got, well, because you know, you got large paintings, but like it's got this, like definitely this three-dimensional feel to it where it doesn't, you know, you forget kind of looking at your paintings that it's a 2D painting. But it's like, but whatever effect that you've created from it doesn't make you feel that way. You do feel like kind of immersed in this like cut three-dimensional world. And so what's, so at the early, so one of the shows that I really liked was when you did it at Book and Job.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in 2023. It was called Superpositions, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. Superpositions.
So that is so interesting to me because that, I love works on paper a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the works in there were works on paper.
Yeah.
But you also did sculptural work,
yeah.
which was crazy. And I, so when I first was like learning about you, I thought like, this is awesome. And this is like what I thought majority of your work was.
Right.
It's now, since then, with the two shows you've had a part two since then, I felt like, oh, this feels like, the stuff you usually do is actually painting on canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something you were trying out.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you because you haven't done sculptural work since that, I don't think, or at least I haven't seen it out in public, but I really love that. Like, I really yeah. love that you were like not only not doing it on paintings, but you're doing like on works on paper, you're mm-hmm. doing sketches. Did you even do prints for that too? I think, right?
I don't think there were prints, but there were these ink drawings.
That was an ink drawing. That's
what, like, yeah, they look kind of like prints.
But took it to real life. And so, like, at that point, like, I didn't even know what to call them, but I think I was like, they look like geometric rocks and shapes, but beautiful, like, really abstract. And, like, you mentioned a lot, like, you like bright colors, which is mm-hmm. what I really attracted me to it, too.
Yeah.
Because I think most of the time when I see something like that, darker, but you really, like, really bring it to life in that way. And then you have these sculptural pieces. So tell me about that. Like, was that like a one-off, or you were trying something new, like you're experimenting? But
well, it felt like a great opportunity. Austin and Adrian offered me this chance to show some paintings and sculptures at their spot, the spot that they've been managing, and
yeah.
studios above Book and Job in the Tenderloin. And you know, so I just kind of wanted to like show, I feel like there are sort of three legs to my practice. Painting is like the main thing.
Yeah.
That's like the true test, I
yeah.
feel like.
Yeah.
And it's kind of constantly challenging. I think of the painting as once the surface is covered, then you really can see what's happening, and then you're like really in the painting.
Right.
You gotta decide whether things work or not.
Right.
So there's no like point of rest.
Right.
Sculpture feels like I really enjoy making sculpture. I like the physicality of it.
Yeah.
I like the material. And it feels like something that I decide what the shape is roughly going to be, and
right.
I just need to work, you know, so I can like just kind of let go.
Yeah.
Let go of like my critical mind in some ways and just pull the shape out of the volume.
Yeah.
I've made several sculptures that are additive, but the ones that were in the show were all these reductive sculptures. So it's cast plaster and vermiculite
yeah.
into this like single block, and then there's no armature or anything. There's no like established idea of exactly what the finished product will be, but it retains some moisture and you can kind of work the material for, you know, up to like a week, and then you let it air dry. So I carve these shapes out, let them dry, sand them down, and seal them with polyurethane. And it feels like a nice way to stay productive and let the painting sort of rest for a little while yeah. I kind of think about things. But they are, I think of them as keys to the paintings.
Yeah.
I think of them as like a reminder. Having them in a show is nice because it's a reminder that the paintings are about space.
Right.
The paintings are these geometric volumes.
Yeah.
And they're like little phrases plucked from the vocabulary of the paintings.
Right.
And they don't have color in them. So they, like, I've painted on sculpture as well, and I'm interested to do that in the future, but that feels like that would start to compete with the paintings. That's mm-hmm. kind of like bringing these two worlds fully together. But having no color on the sculpture, you're just seeing the form, the way the light falls on the form, and it's very concrete. The paintings are meant to be ephemeral and changing.
Right.
And then having the drawings and works on paper, like there are some oil pastels in that show.
Yes.
I just love the material.
I really love those pieces.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The color is fantastic. They're these like Sennelier oil pastels, and the color's just so rich. And you can't mix the color easily, but I'll still make a decision that I don't like and want to change it. And so go in with another oil pastel. And there were times where I was trying to blend and it just really, the texture wasn't working and the end result wasn't what I wanted. So having these colors stacked kind of created an opening for the oil paintings to overlay color in a way that isn't predetermined, but is still a good solution if I find myself like not liking the result. Just go in, see what happens. And this overlay of color can create a nice vibrational effect. That does something different than what I was doing before. But the ink drawings are like the sculpture. Those are reductive. So those, I was painting the negative space to build the lines. And there's no drawing, no plan beforehand. So just start making these negative spaces and seeing what happens. And so the compositions are kind of being generated just through a series of decisions instead of in a planned way.
Yeah.
So they feel like experiments, you know?
Yeah, that's what it kind of, at the time when I saw it, I didn't feel that it was an experiment. I felt like this is like this is a body of work. And it's interesting now seeing the works in the current two shows that was now in retrospect, like I didn't realize an experimental kind of show for you, which was, I thought was really cool. Let's talk about Dreamlands, which is the current show you have up right now. Because we've had this whole conversation now about like about your background and whatever, and so it's interesting to hear how you started out long ago, like as a young kid from Arkansas, and doing representational art and like landscapes, and how like even the birth of the of what you're doing now was out of not convenience, but like of availability of what you had to in order to keep painting, but for the time that you have in your life, right? Because that's everybody, we all have jobs in life,
course.
Right? So what's interesting now is that looking at the work, it's not just a rocky looking mass anymore that's in your paintings. It's like there's now, you're starting to see landscapes again. Like it looks like a location. It looks like something more like than just being abstract. You are now being representational in a way, but still abstract, still staying true to that. But now you're starting to see stuff. And so the question I have for you is like, you know, having had this start where you were kind of that type of artist, is this really a marriage of the two where you're trying to go back to like what that was, but not like all the way, obviously you're still trying to stay true to what this abstract method is that you have now. Like, it's just like, what was the inspiration to go kind of in that direction again, to be representational in some way?
I think in a lot of ways I'm missing the landscape.
Yeah.
But it also felt sort of inevitable.
Yeah.
I mean, I began as this representational painter. I think of my practice as on the spectrum between like fully non-objective abstraction and representational painting.
Right.
But always with an interest of like painting, creating space in some sense. You know, that's like really what I'm interested in. But I was moving my practice from representational closer to abstraction, but it was still very tied to representation. And then out of necessity, there was this kind of break with representational work. And I was trying to use a vocabulary I'd started to build of abstraction to like really hone in on how I could make a painting that felt substantiated without some kind of source material. And for a long time, I wanted it to be a very shallow space. I didn't want it to be representational. I was trying to move away from that in some sense. And, you know, I've kind of slowly drifted back towards representation. But it still feels like the show that's up now is an inversion of the old practice. Mm-hmm. Because the drawing, the paintings start as these fully non-objective drawings.
Right.
And I don't know exactly what the image is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm drawing it, maybe I start to create opportunities I think will, like there will be a basic idea. Like I want a heavy mass kind of higher in the composition, and I want the deep space to be low and in the middle of the painting. Or I want to carve out space in the heavy mass in the middle, and they manifest as these sort of archways.
Right.
So I'm starting to create opportunity, but I don't know what the image is going to be.
Right.
And so then I have to sort of project onto that drawing the solution that I want. But I'm trying to work with the material there. I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't want to deviate too much from the structure I've made. So I have these tight constraints. So I think the practices are like coming closer together, but I'm still on the side of the spectrum that is married to non-objective right now and kind of looking into it to find something that feels representational with the idea that that image will sort of fall apart in some ways.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be too concrete or too resolved. I want it to be, I want it to kind of breathe and change a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea for the paintings last fall, was that they would really shift around on you the more you looked at them. One of the ways I tried to do that is that there's no distinct source of light, whereas in the paintings downstairs with Dreamlands, there's like a directionality of light.
It's yeah.
Like one light source. You know, the tops of planes are illuminated. The shadow is maybe on the right and reflected light is on the left. There's kind of this simple breakdown of how light will fall across the structure that helps you orient yourself in a landscape.
Right.
You know, it ties to the human experience and to perception.
Yeah. I love that too, that because I was going to ask it. Some when I look at one of them, I was like, man, this looks like if I was going out to Arizona in a desert and I see a rock formation out there, yeah. It doesn't seem like any of these are specific places you're thinking of.
No.
It's like coming to you organically as you're putting this together,
right?
Which I think is what makes it cool, because then it opens up to the viewer really turning it into like me, like whatever you think you see.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of indicative of the practice of even making it, right? It's just whatever's like happening, whatever's speaking to you, and then like it just forms out of it, and then the viewer gets to have the same experience as well, it seems like.
And I think one of the benefits of these paintings, I think of them as like they're more discovery than invention.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And the benefit of that is that I'll start the painting with an idea in my mind. That idea doesn't pan out. Like, it almost never comes out the way I was thinking it would.
Yeah.
But the idea that it's almost like the painting presents another idea based on that starting point, and that idea is better than my idea. So I get to find something better than what I started with in the painting.
Yeah.
And usually that thing is a little bit open, you know, it changes a little, it breathes a little, other people will see things I don't see in the paintings. And that's good. And that helps my understanding of the paintings, like seeing how the space is functioning. You know, there are areas that, especially getting into like deep space in the painting, the sky or something, is this part of the sky or is this some distant mountain range that's got a lot of atmosphere and you're not exactly sure, you know, it's starting to like move into this liminal space between like whatever, literal subject matters. So.
Let's see, Dreamlands is up to when? September
6th? September 6th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So good. So, well, I'm going to try and release this by then for people sure. to know, because I think it's a great show, and it's like, I love the work in it.
Oh, thank you.
Ben, but thanks for coming on to this podcast.
Of course.
I really like this. You know what's interesting is that you talked about how you have this teaching background, and it's like, it felt like to me, like I got like a whole art lesson out of this too. No, I mean, I really like it. I think the way you talk about your work is very... introspective and like and very like, well, you could tell there's a lot of experience that comes with where you've gotten this far, but also from I think your teaching experience, and I think the way you explain it is really great. Like,
well, thank you.
Yeah. So the question for you was like, well, you kind of hinted towards it. Like, would you teach again? Like, it feels like.
Yeah, I think I would like to teach again.
I mean, I feel like, I mean, you're an art handler right now. Man, I think you could be a really great teacher but I mean, it all depends on where you're at, where your practice, I guess, like where you want to be career-wise with that. But
yeah, I think, you know, having a really robust painting practice and teaching as well is kind of the goal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Seems like a great life.
Yeah. And you're kind of set on being here. This is like your...
I feel pretty committed. Yeah. My partner Sonia and I have an apartment in Grand Lake and are really happy here. So.
Yeah. Do you go back to Arkansas at all sometimes?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. Most of my family's there. My sister's there. She's got two sons now. My parents are there.
Yeah.
A lot of friends there. So I try to go at least once. These days, even twice a year, for about a week.
What does your people. Parents feel now that you're like out here in a studio doing like?
They're happy for me. I mean, they've always been extremely supportive.
Yeah.
Like being back in Arkansas after grad school, they were like, "You gotta go. You gotta find somewhere." And
I keep equated to like the dad who was like an athlete himself, and then like keeps encouraging the kid to do the sports, and then when they finally do it, and then they're living on their own doing it, it's like I feel like your dad is probably be like, "Yeah,
like, yeah, it's like a point of pride.
I fucking knew it." Like, that's what I think about. That's really cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, man.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's it for today, everyone. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Shannon for coming on. His solo show, Dreamlands, runs at Part 2 Gallery until September 6th, so be sure to check it out. You can learn more about Shannon and his work by visiting his website at johnshannonrogers.com, or you can follow him on Instagram at northofhoxy. Also, be sure to listen to past episodes at wherever you listen to podcasts, and rate and review if you have a chance. Okay, till next time, everyone.